Apparently, imagine dragons have very good dreams. They want to dream. Life ain't what it seems. Oh, everything's a mess. All these sorrows I have seen lead me to believe that everything's a mess. I want to dream. I want to dream. Leave me to dream. Their dreams are better than the life that's actually lived, the sorrows they experience. I dreamed a dream in time gone by when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiving. Then I was young, that love would never die. Then I was young and unafraid, and dreams were made and used and wasted. There was no ransom to be paid, no song unsung, no wine untasted. But the tigers come all at night with their voices soft as thunder as they tear your hopes apart, as they turn your dreams to shame. The text of the most famous Sarah Boyles trying to win Britain's Got Talent. Most remembered audition ever, I think. Blew them away. It's a good song. Everything's a mess. If I have good dreams, I don't tend to remember them. I don't know if I'm like you, but it's the bad ones that wake me up at night, that get marked in my brain as something to recall. It's the scary ones waking me from sleep. Suddenly discovering mine are, I don't know what yours are. I wake up, suddenly discover in my sleep. I'm asleep, and I suddenly find out that there is a crucial final exam in just a few moments for a course I didn't know I was taking. The other common one is, as it's going on, somehow I'm trying to get home and I keep making the wrong turn somehow. I never quite get there. Nebuchadnezzar had a great life, but it's his dream that troubled him. What goes on when that happens with us while scientists are still studying it? It could be your brain reproducing for you or representing to you unconscious desires, or just that you're hearing something around it and your sleepy body is interpreting it in some way or another. At night, you might be processing what you have gathered and experienced during the day. It could even be a form of self-psychoanalysis as you do that to yourself, interpreting those things. Or God could be messaging you. Nebuchadnezzar enjoyed life. His nightmares were a panic. A great statue falls. A glorious golden head, capping ever decreasing inferior layers, standing on a feet of iron and clay. Did you notice in the text, it keeps mentioning over and over again, iron and clay do not mix. They do not mix. They don't bond well. And so it's inherently unstable. And all of that is brought down by some sort of eternal rock. A dream not interpreted, said Rabbi Hizda, is like a letter not read. Nebuchadnezzar wants the letter read, but he's not sure that his advisors are going to get it right. I don't know whether it's because he had read ancient literature at the time. Greek mythology talked about four kingdoms. The Persians talked about kingdoms or eras of metal. So he maybe didn't want to give the advisors the advantage of what they already knew. He said, no, you tell me the dream. And then I'll know you've got it right. So what does this suggest to us? If we separate ourselves from the immediate prophecy, this says to us that life is out of control, out of our control. As good as we have established it, the gold bit, going all the way down, rooted to the ground, it's unstable, and life can just get in and ruin it. I had a great sermon prepared for you and for the 8:30 service, and sitting right about where you are, Ruth Malloy has a little fainting spell and falls over, and I didn't finish it. They didn't get to hear all of this. Gwen asked her, said, you know, what do you think caused it? She said, well, it might have been the sermon. Just a fair warning, you just don't know. This church, one Sunday morning, I think after the 8:30 service, David Whitehouse was preparing for communion right over here. Fainted. Actually, he died right there. So the congregation had to pause and reflect and pray, which is what we did for Ruth this morning. She's Gwen and she are now over at... she walked out under her own power, by the way, so it's probably... That happened to her actually during the summer, so we'll hear back and I'll let you know how that happens. You might want to pray for her too, Ruth Malloy. You don't know what's going to happen, how tragedy is going to come. Life is out of... Matter of fact, the most important things in life we have the least control over. The loves we have. One of the reasons why you're still dazzled by the sunsets, you didn't have anything to do with that. It's not in your control, and it's so wonderful. Life is out of control, but it's also out of control in the sense that pain is coming. You know it. I know it. None of us here, I don't think, nurture the illusion that because we believe in Jesus, there will be no pain or suffering. Life is out of control, and it will inconvenience us too. In Daniel, what this suggests is that we share the fate of the city. If you were to try to place Daniel on this thing, he's up there with the golden head. Last week, we saw him rise to the head of the student body, winning the Babylonian idol contest, I suppose it was. Now he's a part of the system. He belongs to Babylon. Kill all the wise men of Babylon. And of course, Daniel would go with them. Fascinating for somebody who was displaced, an exile, a refugee, if you will. Not exactly a refugee unless he's staying in Babylon. We become part of the system. As Jeremiah said, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. And pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. So what does that make us then? We are being sent, as it were, into this city of Toronto, but our citizenship is of a different place. It's of a more transcendent place. Our essential belonging is with God and God's kingdom and God's priorities, but we are here with the system as it is. In introducing this series, I mentioned this phrase. I just want to go into it a little bit further. You remember the phrase internal emigre? It is a phrase that was coined in the 1920s in the Soviet Union to refer to people who were Soviets, who lived in the Soviet Union, but their values and attitudes differed from the Soviet Union. The term was used as a slam term against writers. They're not really of us. They belong to somewhere else. They've left the country, even though physically they're here. The same term can be applied to Christians. We are in the world, but not of the world. So how does that work out? The three general responses to that. You can, if you can't beat them, you join them. And this is the problem of accommodation that both Jews and Christians and Muslims actually face. That you just become a regular part of the culture and invisible and therefore no longer salt and light, but just along with the same as everybody. You don't bring anything from God to contribute. If you can't beat them, join them. Or you take the opposite approach. If you can't join them, beat them. And this is where you become hard-nosed. You insist on keeping your tradition over against everything else so that you not only seem irrelevant, but you seem like a fanatic. But there's a third way. Neither, if you can't join them, beat them, or if you can't beat them, join them. But don't try to beat them or join them, but live in reverence to God, who then puts you into the body as, in Daniel's case, as a bit of a servant. And he serves, but not as a part, totally as a part of the system. Yes, he shares the faith, but also he has the transcendent values, as I mentioned, from God. And from Daniel, here in this story, King Nebuchadnezzar learned something very important, that he's not in control either. That even the system Daniel's a part of is broken and faulted. Notice, if you're troubled with dreams, found this from the Jewish Talmud. Here's a good prayer. Lord of the universe, I am yours and my dreams are yours. I dreamed a dream, I don't know what it is. If my dreams be good dreams, strengthen and fortify them, and may they be fulfilled like the dreams of Joseph. But if they be bad and must be amended, heal them as the waters of Marah were healed by the hands of Moses, our teacher. So either way, turn all of my dreams into good ones. Good prayer. I like that. Notice, as Daniel was going through this, the tremendous respect he accords the king. Did you notice that one phrase? You are the King of Kings. You read that and you go, no, Daniel, you got that one wrong. That belongs to Jesus. We sing the song, Handel wrote the piece, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. We all know that applies to Jesus. But here he's applying it to the pagan king, who didn't really learn his lessons very well, because next week we'll look at he's going to put up a statue and have people worship it. Didn't quite get it all. But what's interesting is Daniel says, you are King of Kings. When Nebuchadnezzar comes back and acknowledges that what Daniel said is true and that he had the right angle on it, he says, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of Kings. Echoing Daniel's language, in serving the king, Daniel made a substantial change to how Nebuchadnezzar was thinking about God. So, life is out of control. We share the fate of this city. Thirdly, trust God. The whole thing is about God. Albert Einstein's wife was asked during his lifetime if she could explain the theory of general relativity. And she said, well, no, I don't understand it, but I know Albert and he can be trusted. That's the point. We don't know what God is doing, but God can be trusted. When life is out of control, when everything's a mess. As for how Daniel went about predicting the dream, children, don't try this at home. The point is, only God can do this. Only God can give and interpret the dream. So we're not being taught here some sort of dream interpretation technique. Only God also can bring down every kingdom. Only God turns despots to praise him. And Nebuchadnezzar is given the punchline of the passage. Surely your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal the dream. So when you're looking at this passage and looking at the various bits and pieces of it, trying to interpret it, don't get lost in the details. It's all about God. Nebuchadnezzar ruled at God's pleasure. And his life would end, and so would his kingdom. But if you insist on looking at the details of the prophecy. Look, interpretation is really easy looking backwards. It's fascinating. There's one of the sub little headings on Glenn and Mary, and I don't know if you, in studying the New Testament, always go to my source, which is Wikipedia. There's this long list of all of the scholars who've looked at this passage and commented on what the interpretation is. It's fascinating to read because the one column that says about the four major ones, it's the same four kingdoms: Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Done deal. Easy. A lot of discussion about the mixed kingdom, iron and clay. Not quite sure what that is. Some even try to go on to establish a physical in the world kingdom like the Holy Roman Empire for the kingdom that God brought in. But we've given up on that idea. Jesus, it's a place where Jesus is being referred to here. Surely the God of gods, Lord of lords, and a revealer of mysteries. And Daniel says, the King of heaven will set up a kingdom that will, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush those kingdoms and bring them to an end. But in itself will endure forever. It's referring to Jesus. Remember, Jesus referred to himself as the rock, the cornerstone that the builders rejected. It's a different kind of kingdom. And it's marvelous in our eyes, says Psalm 118. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. Another point in all of this is that God will not let decline go on forever. God will intervene as things go from bad to worse eventually. Even if your worst nightmares come to pass about who is to be elected leader of the free world to the south of us. There's been so much discussion about this up here. It's fascinating. The stone that turns into the mountain is Jesus, and our focus is there. His kingdom has already begun. And God willing, we can experience more and more of it. By the way, many down south are lamenting the fading of what I grew up knowing as the American dream. It's been in decline for a long time, I've been told. President Obama described it as it's actually going in reverse. It's getting worse for people instead of better. Others say the dream is dead or dying. That's another thing you can Google, lots of articles. ABC even carried an article on it. Fewer and fewer U.S. citizens hope to own a home or even to graduate from university. The wealthy 1% own Congress, and it's legal. Princeton University defines the U.S. as no longer a democracy but an oligarchy, the rule of the few. And the middle class is fading fast. If that gold giant is teetering, there are many people wondering whether Canada can pick up the torch. Can we provide the kind of environment in which, well, what is the American dream? Here it is, written in the 1930s. The yearning for affluence and the chance to overcome barriers and social class to become the best we can be. The yearning for affluence and the chance to overcome barriers and social class to become the best we can be. That's the dream. And that's what, frankly, the refugees are hoping for as they're heading toward this land. Some opportunity. It has got to be better than life on the fringes, says Ali in the Globe. He's from Syria. You know the story. The Syrian crops failed. The Assad kingdom was slow to respond, and once it did, it was brutal. In the vacuum, ISIS has set up their own unimaginably heartless kingdom caliphate. You see the decline. And now in Jordanian refugees' camps, everything's a mess. Ali's family survives on his meager black market wages. He doesn't have a work permit, so he has to sneak off and get work. What is his dream? We just want the best for our kids. We don't want them to be like us. We want them to be better than us. Kamal dreams, he's on the far right. Kamal dreams of an education for my kids. His pregnant wife, Nazreen, interjects, and security. And he nods, safety and security and education. Another refugee says she just wants to be in a place where she can give back. Actually, Daniel's posture in Babylon. I just want to give back. Those are good dreams, part of God's dream of a reconciling revolution, of the healing of wounds, of feasts and banquets, of a worldwide web of love. I dream of God dancing in the streets of East York. Wouldn't that be fun to see? Seek first God's kingdom. Let your little dreams be part of God's big dream before somebody sprays pepper spray all over them. As the story goes, the Earl of County Clark, loved to ride his horse through his vast estate. One day when he was doing that, he came upon one of his tenant farmers, old Hans. Hans was in the shade of a great oak, bowed in prayer. The Earl sat on his horse and just waited. When Hans looked up, he was most apologetic. He said, "Excuse me, sir, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you approach." He dusted himself off. "I was just giving thanks to my Lord for my lunch." Hans looked down at the dark bread and the moldy cheese that Hans was eating and said, "You know, I wouldn't be given too many thanks for that lunch." Hans laughed with him and said, "It's sufficient for me. My sweet Mary made the bread. And the cheese was made from Bessie, our Guernsey." "But sir, it's remarkable that you should come by. I feel I should tell you, just last night I had this strange dream. It was full of beauty and of peace, but then I heard a voice saying, 'The richest man in the valley will die tonight. The richest man in the valley will die tonight.' And it's probably nothing, but I thought I should let you know." Perturbed, the Earl harumphed, "Nonsense," and rode off. As horse and rider faded in the distance, Hans prayed, "Lord, have mercy on him if he really is to die tonight." "Die tonight," said the Earl to himself. "Ridiculous. Forget it." But once you plant a thought like that in your head, you can't forget it. So he worried about it. Yeah, he was feeling fine until Hans said that he was going to die tonight. So he called his doctor. Doctor said, "Poppycock. I just looked at you, but let me come over and I'll put your mind at ease, do you a little examination, take a look at you." The examination complete, the doctor said, "You're healthy as a horse. There's no way you're dying tonight." The Earl felt relieved and a little foolish. The very next morning, a messenger arrived at the Earl's door. "It's Hans," said the messenger. "Old Hans died in his sleep last night."
Please stand.